Hard-working, tax-paying Americans have a lot in common with undocumented immigrants.
So the disbelief of many people, undocumented folks, regardless of their status, still file their taxes year after year.
A look at hard-working, tax-paying non-citizens this tax season. Also, how states across the country respond to an opioid crisis with many different faces.
Medical examiner's offices are struggling with overcrowding in the morgues. In some communities, they're having to bring in trailers to store bodies.
How is your community responding to the opioid crisis?
We're a small community, so drug addiction impacts us much harder.
Various professional agencies are collaborating and working diligently towards a solution.
I know a lot of halfway houses where they recover.
This is The Takeaway for Friday, April 13th, 2018. As we get closer to tax day, that's Tuesday the 17th this year, by the way, we begin with the voice of a U.S. taxpayer.
I was born in Mexico, and at the age of two, I migrated with my parents to New York. I'm 25 now, so I've been in the United States for a little bit over two decades. I've grown up here. This is where I call my home. This is where my friends are, and this is where my community is.
That's Yetziri Tovar. She's a taxpayer, but also an undocumented immigrant. Yetziri is a DACA recipient who works at Make the Road New York, an immigrant advocacy group. Roughly 12.5 million people are living in the United States without legal status right now. Now, there's a charge that's as old as migration to the United States itself, that immigrants don't pay their fair share, that they're a drain on public resources. Well, today, we wanted to make a fact check on that claim.
Roughly somewhere between 50 to 75% of undocumented immigrants do file income taxes and pay payroll taxes through the use of the I-10. For DACA recipients, it's another story. It's really every DACA recipient is paying and filing income taxes.
That's Meg Weehy there, Deputy Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. We'll hear more from Meg in just a minute, but here's Yetziri Tovar again talking about why both she and her parents, who are not DACA eligible, pay taxes.
For as long as I can remember, my parents have been filing their taxes using an ITIN number, which they applied to the IRS. So my parents have been contributing year after year. Now with the DACA program, DACA recipients are able to apply for a social security number. So ever since I was able to work legally in the United States, I've been working and I've been filing my taxes. Even though at the end of the day, we don't benefit from any of the program, Social Security, that we're actually paying into.
So hang on a second, Yetziri. You have a Social Security number. Do you pay that Social Security tax, that what's called the FICA tax? You pay those taxes but have no expectation of any benefit?
Yeah, so every year, I actually filed my taxes last weekend, last Saturday. I woke up really early and I went to my accountant to file, knowing that I wouldn't benefit for any of other programs that people here who are citizens would be able to benefit from. And that's because also of the inaction of Congress. Congress has left many people like myself in the limbo after Trump ended DACA. So we don't know what's going to happen with our lives. We're fighting for a path to citizenship, to contributing even more to this country, but Congress is just not acting on it.
So look, Yetziri, you're young and you might not be too worried about Social Security just yet. Your parents are further along than you are. They're probably thinking about it a lot more than you are. I know for many decades they probably haven't had an expectation of Social Security benefits at all because they know the law, but they've been paying taxes for all these many decades, and that's a drain on their own finances.
Yes, I mean, they're the ones that have been telling me, file your taxes, make sure you file it. You only have a couple of months. They actually filed their taxes way ahead of than I did. They did it back in February. And it's because they understand that this is a commitment that they have done to this country, to this country that they've been living here for over two decades. They know it's the right thing to do. And they know that if one day further along there is some type of immigration reform, this would actually play in their favor. And they know that even though they're contributing and paying into these programs, they will never benefit. So it's definitely heartbreaking that I know that my parents won't have any type of security after they decide to retire. And maybe retirement is not even an option right now for them.
Now, you mentioned that your parents have paid taxes all along, knowing that eventually it may play in their favor. What did you mean?
People are always talking about undocumented folks being a drain in their economy, being lazy, not working. I mean, I think Trump called us lazy. He has called us so many things. I've lost track at this point. But we know that it's the right thing to do, and that's what we've been trying to do. And that's why my parents, year after year, they pay their taxes. They make sure that gets done right before the April deadline. And it's something that they have taught me to be diligent with my taxes and pay it ahead of time.
Yetziri Tovar, DACA recipient and taxpayer. Yetziri, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We turn now to Meg Wehe. Meg is deputy director of ITEP, the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, where she's worked on the economic impact of DACA recipients and undocumented immigrants. And I asked her if the experience of Yetziri Tovar, a DACA recipient, sounds familiar.
Sounds very typical. My organization, the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, has for years been producing research estimating the state and local tax contributions that the more than 11 million undocumented immigrants pay every year, which we haven't really touched on yet. Yatsiri has talked a lot about filing income taxes, but I think it's important to note that at the state and local level, we collect sales taxes, which means every time someone purchases clothing or some other good or service, they're paying sales taxes. Everyone who owns a home or rents an apartment is paying property taxes, either directly or indirectly. So we're all taxpayers, regardless of our immigration status, and well beyond even paying payroll and income taxes.
Give me a sense of the overall contribution of undocumented immigrants to the tax revenues of the United States. And how important is it to the overall revenue for Uncle Sam?
Well, to the point that I just made, I think I would argue that all undocumented immigrants pay some sort of tax because sales and property taxes, excise taxes are pretty unavoidable. There's a sort of a myriad of research that shows roughly somewhere between 50 to 75% of undocumented immigrants do file income taxes and pay payroll taxes through the use of the I-10 that was mentioned earlier. For DACA recipients, it's another story. It's really every DACA recipient is paying and filing income taxes. And that's because, as Yetziri said, they're given temporary Social Security numbers and they're required by law to file their personal income taxes. And then, of course, those payroll taxes that fund both Medicare and Social Security are taking out of their paycheck.
So Meg, Yetziri is a DACA recipient. She has a temporary Social Security number, as you mentioned. Her parents aren't DACA recipients. They don't have Social Security numbers. How do people like Yetziri's parents pay taxes?
They apply for and have to renew for something called an individual taxpayer identification number. And that is what is used in the absence of having a Social Security number. I think it's also, though, important to note that under tax law, regardless of your immigration status, employers are also required to file taxes and withhold employment taxes for the wages that they receive. So even an undocumented immigrant without an I-10 number may be having payroll taxes withhold from their paycheck.
You know, on the face of it, Meg, it sounds like an undocumented immigrant who's undocumented and not in contact with the government in other ways would be skittish or nervous about applying for an ITIN, getting registered with the IRS in this way, but people still do it.
Absolutely. And I think that, again, it was touched on earlier, one of there are many reasons for that. I think one is that undocumented immigrants really want to be front to prove their economic contribution to the U.S., document their residence here, and that they have been paying taxes. And in fact, some of the comprehensive immigration bills that have come through Congress, including that in 2013, the bill that was passed by the Senate, would require some sort of documentation that undocumented immigrants had been paying their taxes, basically, since they arrived here. So I think there's both a sense of wanting to feel like they're a contributor to our community and to our society, but also it isn't important to building that path for citizenship that many hope that they'll one day have.
Now, Meg, your work and the tax load paid by DACA recipients wound up being pretty important in court when lawyers were filing against the Trump administration's move to rescind the DACA program. Can you explain the connection between those two things, between taxes and how the courts have ruled on DACA?
Well, there were two pieces of litigation, one led by the Attorney General in New York and one by, I believe, four plaintiffs in California. But both of those pieces of litigation had multiple states' attorney generals sign on. And the build for the case had many, many parts to it. But one of the arguments made by the attorneys generals in those states was that ending DACA would cause an economic or fiscal strain to their states, because there was a recognition that DACA recipients were major providers of state and local tax revenue. And in some cases, that's even more so than the general undocumented immigrant population, because DACA recipients, by having temporary work authorization, also have higher wages. It allows them to have higher wages. And most DACA recipients are indeed working. So our research that shows that DACA recipients pay close to $2 billion in state and local taxes, and of course, for those court cases, we had amounts for each of the states, was really used, again, to build the case that by ending DACA could cause some financial strain to the state.
You know, I hear you say this, Meg, and I get the exact opposite conclusion that some people would draw, which is that DACA recipients, undocumented immigrants, are a drain on resources. Your research told the court that, in fact, it's quite the opposite.
That's correct. And I, you know, whenever I hear that drain on resources argument, it's a bit infuriating to me, honestly, because I think, you know, I don't think it makes sense to draw a balance line under anyone, not under you or me, whether or anyone, regardless of their legal status. Because how do you plausibly quantify the value of public education, the value of public safety, having clean water, clean air, healthcare, well-maintained roads, and do that on this sort of per-person basis, especially because all of these public benefits that our tax dollars pay for have multiple spillover effects, both not only to other people, but long-term effects as well. And that's why I think that the better question to ask is the one that we've been talking about, you know, today, which is whether or not undocumented immigrants or DACA recipients are paying their fair share in taxes. And when that question is asked, the obvious answer is yes. And I like to point out that not only are they paying their fair share of taxes, but they pay a higher share of their income on average in state and local taxes than the top 1% of taxpayers, the top 1% richest taxpayers in our country.
Meg Wehe is Deputy Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Meg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yesterday was Holocaust Remembrance Day, and there's a new survey assessing Americans' knowledge of the Holocaust. The survey was commissioned by the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany. They're a group that advocates for social services for victims of the Holocaust. Now, that survey interviewed more than 1,300 Americans. It found that 41% of Americans and 66% of millennials can't say what Auschwitz was. 52% of Americans wrongly think Hitler came to power through force, and more than a fifth of millennials aren't sure if they've even heard of the Holocaust. Now, on our Facebook page, we asked what you thought about the survey results, and here's what some of you said. Dale wrote, "Yes, our history is really lacking. In my high school, we barely got through the Civil War." And Edward wrote this, "We learned about the Holocaust at age 9 or 10, both in school and from our parents. These numbers of people who don't know about it today represent something very scary about our society today and for the future." We want you to weigh in on this discussion. Go to our Facebook page and see what other Takeaway listeners are saying about these survey results and share your story there with us. You can also always tweet us at The Takeaway. And we return now to our ongoing coverage of the opioid crisis in America. Depending on where you live in the United States, the crisis can look very different. And that matters when it comes to how local officials are confronting it. Take Oregon, for example. Opioid-assisted overdoses have dropped 20% from their peak a few years back. Sarah Rothenfluke from Oregon Public Broadcasting gives us an overview.
Oregon set up a task force to really push new guidelines. They push clinics and hospitals to change their prescribing practice, push doctors to incorporate pain management into their continuing education efforts, and emphasize the use of prescription drug monitoring. There's a website in which doctors can trace the use of opioids, not just here in Oregon, but across the river into Washington as well. Doctors have also worked hard to provide people who are suffering from long-term chronic pain with lots of alternative ways of managing that. Acupuncture, physical therapy, eating healthy, even a fascinating thing with virtual reality.
So that appears to be a brightening picture in Oregon, but in Ohio, things feel less hopeful. The state is second only to West Virginia in its rate of drug overdoses. Marlene Harris-Taylor of IdeaStream gives us the snapshot from Cleveland.
There's still 11 people a day dying from drug overdoses in Ohio, and there's no signs that the crisis has hit its peak. That's what we're hearing from state officials. Medical examiner's offices are struggling with overcrowding in the morgues. In some communities, they're having to bring in trailers to store bodies. And pain pills, heroin, and cocaine are being laced with a powerful synthetic opioid called fentanyl. In fact, the Ohio Department of Health put out an advisory about fentanyl because last year in 2017, 71% of all unintentional drug overdose deaths involved fentanyl or fentanyl analogs in the state. So some people say it's no longer a heroin crisis in Ohio. It's now a fentanyl crisis in Ohio.
Marlene Harris-Taylor of IdeaStream in Cleveland there. Finally, we move to Rochester in western New York, where Evan Dawson of WXXI has an update from an area hit hard by the crisis.
The surge in heroin and opioid deaths here happened in 2016 when more than 200 people died, up from around 80 the year before. The average age of overdose death here is 36, but it ranges from the teens to 76. So heroin is a huge problem, but so is opioid addiction in patients who were simply trying to manage pain. And our county executive has appointed a physician's council to offer a medical approach to the crisis that involves re-educating the public about our expectations for managing pain. In other words, opioids will be available in cases of acute pain, but doctors would like to start moving patients to other treatments. That's going to be difficult for existing patients who have to rely on opioids, and it's a challenge for a public that has been told for years that they can expect to live without pain.
So, a focus on prescriptions in western New York, a fentanyl crisis in Ohio, and some hope for alternative treatments in Oregon. Three states, three different pictures of the opioid crisis and the efforts to ease it. Well, Herman Lopez is here with me now. He's senior reporter for Vox. Herman, you heard those three dispatches from three states, all corners of the country. What's your reaction?
I'm not really surprised, just based on what we've seen with the opioid crisis so far. The way I look at it is there are three things that you want to look at a state to see whether it will have a big opioid problem today. One, did it originally have a painkiller problem? That's the first thing. Two, did it have an initial heroin market? So like particularly in a state like Ohio, Columbus already had a fairly large heroin market, and that made it easy for heroin to spread across the state. And then three, does it have good access to treatment? This is something that we see across the state. Some states are better than others. New York City, for example, has a lot of methadone clinics already, whereas in Ohio, they have really bad access to treatment in general, and that's created more problems.
Well, let's talk more about the response, Herman. States look to other states for best practices, things that are working. Who's doing this right? What state is really leading the way in responding to the crisis here?
So I just mentioned New York, which is doing pretty well. But I think one of the best examples here is Vermont, which they built what they call a hub and spoke system, essentially. And that's just a fancy way of describing what they really did is just integrated addiction treatment into the rest of the healthcare system. So normally, if you look at addiction care in the U.S., it's really fragmented. There aren't really strong regulatory standards. This is a huge problem, particularly in places like Florida, where there are all these addiction, quote unquote, clinics that essentially are scams. There's might not even be a doctor on staff. Vermont took this approach where through the healthcare system, they really funded an increase in providing better treatment for opioid addiction with a focus on medications like buprenorphine and methadone, which are considered the gold standard of treatment. And the people within their care saw dramatic, we're talking 90%+ decreases in opioid use and overdoses. The important thing to emphasize here is that all Vermont really did is they took the evidence we already have and just put more money and more infrastructure behind it through the healthcare system. They didn't come up with something that like no other state knew about. They just really built up their addiction treatment, added some regulations and rules to it, and integrated into the rest of the healthcare system.
Well, that's fascinating because the early heroin crisis, the latest wave of it, I mean, 8-10 years ago, hit Vermont especially hard. you're saying they're responding quite well. Can other states just replicate this? Vermont is a small state for sure, but can they just export this model?
Some states are actually looking at taking Vermont's model. The biggest thing seems to be political will. So like I just mentioned, it's not that we in general don't know what to do about it. We do know that buprenorphine, methadone, naltrexone, these are medications that really do work to like address opioid addiction. In studies, people who are on these medications see a 50% plus drop in their mortality rate, which is really impressive in general for any medical intervention. The biggest thing seems to be political will. So there are two challenges here. One is funding. But the second thing, and this is what when I went to Vermont and asked the officials there about this, they said that the biggest thing was actually just overcoming stigma. A lot of people still do not see addiction as a medical problem. They do not see these medications as a good solution to that problem. So there's all this stigma attached to addiction still. And when you're dealing with that, it's a lot harder to convince state officials to really build up their addiction treatment systems.
Well, Hermanis, states take different approaches to this crisis. You know, in some states, there are different approaches to liberalization of marijuana laws, Colorado, California, other places as well. I want to play you a call from a listener in Colorado who's responding to reports that better access to marijuana may be helping in some cases.
My name is Dave, calling from Loveland, Colorado, and I'd say to statistically, the opioid crisis is slowly improving in Colorado. Part of that's due to the legalization of marijuana and the cannabinoids within the plant that can help somebody with a plethora of ailments like arthritis, stress, eating disorders, anger, neuropathy, and even chronic pain.
Now, Herman, Dave is just one person from Loveland, Colorado. That's an anecdotal report. Is he onto something? What do the studies show?
There are some studies that show an association between looser marijuana laws and reduced opioid deaths. The one thing that's tricky here, and I actually just talked to a few experts about this in the past few days because it's something I'm looking into myself, and a lot of people just aren't convinced by this evidence yet because it's the old this is correlation, not causation thing. So one question, for example, is in these states that have relaxed their marijuana laws, they tend to be more liberal. So that might have made them more likely to, say, let's increase the amount of naloxone, which is an opioid overdose antidote. Like, let's increase access to it. And the studies so far really have not been able to tear this all apart in terms of like what is actually causing the reduction in opioid deaths. So while the studies so far do seem a bit promising, I would say that the evidence is still fairly early and people should be cautious in interpreting it.
Well, Herman, the last time you and I talked, it was when the White House, when President Trump released a new framework for combating the opioid crisis from the top. It had lots of different aspects to it. That was, I think, about a month ago. Any impact in these states from the new White House initiatives?
So far, not really. I mean, in terms of what the White House suggested, they really wanted to do the criminal justice stuff. Trump really emphasized the death penalty for drug traffickers. We did see the Justice Department put out a memo asking federal prosecutors to essentially try to take up the death penalty more in big drug trafficking cases. It's not clear at all whether federal prosecutors will actually respond to that memo and like actually take it up. And in general, Trump had this opioid commission last year that made dozens of recommendations to deal with the crisis. And at best, he's maybe started on a handful of them. Senators from around the country, Senators Murray and Senators Warren, just sent out a letter this week asking the Trump administration to explain which of the recommendations it has done so far. They have not gotten a response. And in general, it's been like really hard to get the White House to answer this. What is the status on these recommendations? Are you pursuing them? Because so far, it doesn't seem like the White House has taken that much action. Congress has taken some action in terms of like putting more money towards the epidemic. The recent budget approved more than $3 billion for the next fiscal year for this. But it's not totally clear just how that money will go out yet and how effective it'll be. And that's something that remains to be seen.
Herman Lopez, senior reporter for Vox. Herman, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And also big thanks to our friends at OPB, at IdeaStream, and WXXI for their dispatches there. They were part of the series Opioid Crisis, The Ripple Effect. We have a link on our website. And remember, you can find all of our opioid coverage on the website at thetakeaway.org/opioids. How is your community dealing with the opioid crisis?
I'm Jordan from The Dalles, Oregon.
And I don't believe that it is improving. We're a small community, so drug addiction impacts us much harder, as we lack the resources of a larger city to help and mitigate drug abuse.
This is Frank from Westbury, New York. I live very near to Suffolk County, near Levittown, which I think is almost ground zero for the opioid epidemic. A lot of the children of baby boomers who work hard but maybe are not able to change with technology get depressed and start doing the drugs. I know a lot of halfway houses like Oxford House where they recover, but I know it's a very long, expensive, tedious process with a lot of relapse.
This is Michelle St. Clement. I'm calling from Traverse City, Michigan. The opioid crisis in northern Michigan has become a tremendous problem since the drug traffickers have been filtering up from downstate. Here in Traverse City, where I live, various professional agencies are collaborating and working diligently towards a solution. Our famous state theater will be holding a free viewing of a documentary film regarding the opioid crisis, and they'll be holding a panel discussion afterwards.
Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Let's go to Virginia now and a fight over Medicaid in that state. State lawmakers in Virginia returned to Richmond this week for a special legislative session. Democratic Governor Ralph Northam is just a couple of months into his first term, but he called the special session to address the state budget blocked last month by Republican senators in Virginia. A Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act is the big issue here. 400,000 Virginia low-income residents stand to gain health coverage under Medicaid if the expansion the governor wants gets through. State Senator Emmett Hanger is a Republican representing Virginia's 24th district. That's in the Shenandoah Valley, right around Charlottesville. He's in favor of a Medicaid expansion in Virginia. And I asked the senator about the special session and the fight over Medicaid.
We attempted to access the federal funds through Medicaid this past session. That one part of our legislative body, the House of Delegates, included that in their budget. The Senate, which I'm a member, did not, so we got hung up on that. So we've not finalized our biennial budget. And the big debate, of course, focuses around whether or not we should expand access under Medicaid to individuals under 138% of poverty. I've been a supporter of that for a long time, but it seems like the stars might be aligning right now where we can actually push it across the finish line.
So you say the stars are aligning to finally do that Medicaid expansion. Why now? What's changed?
Well, ironically, the Senate in the past, we're at 21-19 right now in the Senate, 21 Republicans, 19 Democrats, and it's been that way for a while. On the House side, a fairly large majority of Republicans up until this past election, and after the election, different composition over there, and that really has been the holdup where they really hadn't wanted to do it. Now, the ironic part is, of course, they've taken the lead with a plan to expand Medicaid. I have a plan that would also do that, and to get that accomplished, I need another vote or two aligning with myself and the Democrats who have agreed basically to go with the plan that we have developed in order to get it passed. So the governor, the current governor, he's a fellow that's somewhat laid back, easy to get along with, but we are at odds. He has a plan, the House has a plan, and then it's going to be a bit difficult for us to get a plan out of the Senate this year, and that's why we're in special session now to work out those differences.
So, Senator Hanger, you're a Republican who's trying to whip support for the Medicaid expansion. It makes you a little bit of an outlier in your party. Oh, why are you different? Why have you decided that the Commonwealth of Virginia should expand Medicaid for low-income people when so many of your Republican colleagues don't think so?
My history of it goes back to when the Affordable Care Act was first passed and we had to make a decision. After the court ruled that, you know, the states had that authority, and we do have that authority. I agree with that. I really have recognized the need. We have a lot of disparity in the Commonwealth. If you go into the suburbs of Northern Virginia, we have some of the best health outcomes in the nation, average lifespan of 85. You go to the South Side of Virginia, Southwest Virginia, we have some of the probably worst health outcomes in the nation, where the average life expectancy is in the 60s. And there's just so much difference there. Basically, what sold me on it is the Medicaid program certainly needed some reforms. And we actually have gone through a series of reforms over the last several years. I led an effort with a Medicaid Innovation Reform Commission. We accomplished what we were supposed to do. Plus, one of the positives with the Trump administration, the new director for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services actually is someone that I agree with her philosophy, in that she has indicated, and this is where I come down, we really should be giving a hand up to individuals that have mental health issues, substance abuse issues, or just health unaddressed physical health issues that prevent them from entering the workforce, and they live on the edges of poverty or in poverty. And I really believe if we do this appropriately with a hands-up approach to a work requirement, some skin in the game, and some encouragement and resources behind it, that we can use the Medicaid program to help move people from poverty to more self-sufficiency and prosperity. So that really is my slogan at this point. And the new director of CMS, it appears, is going to be flexible in terms of allowing the states to tailor programs to the needs of the individual states. So I'm wanting to put Virginia out on the front in terms of coming up with a Medicaid program that helps people as intended, but as temporary. In other words, these individuals that can move on in life and do better for themselves, they would only be on Medicaid in a transitional period.
All right, Senator, let's talk about politics for just one moment. You said the stars are starting to align here for Medicaid expansion. Look, Republicans lost 15 seats in Virginia in the House of Delegates in the last election just a few months ago. It looks like a bad year for Republicans in other elections taking shape in 2018. Does that have a lot to do with it? Do Republicans in Virginia see the writing on the wall and realize that Medicaid expansion is something that a lot of voters just want?
I believe that the dynamic in the House of Delegates takes that into account. Certainly, they've been refreshed with the elections. But the truth of the matter is, you have in the House 49 Democrats that are solidly behind it. And of course, that's the partisan political alignment on this issue. But then you also have a number of Republicans like this being able to come up with a reasonable work requirement and getting a waiver to do that. So, yeah, it's mixed. There are some people that recognize that their citizens want it, and that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to be informed representatives, but we're also supposed to address the will of the people when it's appropriate.
Well, Senator, I'm going to let you go, but you mentioned that it's going to be tough for you and some of your Republican colleagues to agree with the governor over things like work requirements and what you call skin in the game for Medicaid. You think at the end of this special session, you all are going to get agreement and expand the program?
I believe we will. I'm giving it hopefully a couple week period where we can basically stake out our positions and then get around the table and negotiate our differences away where we can come to a compromise. And we have a history of doing that here in Virginia, and so hopefully we will exercise that history and we'll come up with a good agreement that will work well for the Commonwealth.
State Senator Emmett Hanger, Republican from the 24th District in Virginia. Senator, thank you so much.
It's good to talk to you today.
Do you remember very much?
The boy. Is he dead too?
Who?
The boy, Jason.
I'm going to give it to you straight about Jason. Still out there, some sort of demented creature.
It's Jason Voorhees.
Jason, Mother is talking to you.
I never really chopped wood before.
It's Friday the 13th. I think that's why we got Friday the 13th montage, courtesy of Jason Cowett in our control room. Jason, was that you? You've been a naughty boy. Friday the 13th. Movie time. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and The Takeaway is here with us. Hi, Rafer.
Hi, Todd.
Hey, Rafer, you want some Friday the 13th trivia?
Oh, yeah. Lay it on me.
Yeah, I will. And hold on to this. We'll get the answer at the end. People can tweet me if they think they know the answer. I'm going to confess this one's not super easy. How many Friday the 13th movies are there, Rafer? Dig
Ooh.
Deep. There's a lot of them. I'll give you that hint. There's a lot of them. How many Friday the 13th movies? Hold on to that. We'll get back to it at the end. Let's start with this weekend's movies with Truth or Dare. This is Jeff Wadlow, director. Rafer, I'm led to believe this is a harmless game of Truth or Dare that turns out to be not so harmless. Listen.
Truth or Dare? Dare. Dare you to follow through with your promise. Break Olivia's hand. Obviously, this was you.
Marky, why would I dare you to break my own hand?
I don't know. What are you doing?
You have to do it.
What?
Rafer, Truth or Dare was fun when I was a kid. What is this?
Well, you know, when teenagers and drinking are involved, things always go badly. You know, in horror movies, this is seven college kids who go to Mexico for a spring break. They play Truth or Dare with some beers, but they do it in an old church. Unbeknownst to them, there's some demon involved here that follows them home and forces them to keep playing the game. And of course, if you break the rules, if you don't participate, if you tell a lie, you will die. So this is actually kind of more of a chiller than a horror movie, I would say. Not a lot of blood and guts and gore here. It's a lot of fun kind of watching this sort of monkey's paw tale unfold. You know, every teenager's got a secret, of course. There's one guy who's gay. There's one woman who's in love with her best friend's boyfriend. Stuff like that. Oh, no, truth or dare? Is the game going to force me to reveal something? It's a lot of fun, actually. You know, I think this is another great example of the rebirth of the horror genre that we're seeing with Get Out and things like the success of Insidious. It Follows, the indie horror movie from a few years back. This genre is really booming, and I think this is a great example of it. I really had a lot of fun watching this.
I was rolling my eyes during the clip, and I saw the trailer, but I got to say, you might have won me over. I might have to go for Truth or Dare this weekend, because I've been enjoying the rebirth of the genre for sure.
Yeah. You know, look, you know, manage expectations. We're not talking about a masterpiece here, but, you know, again, it's kind of a macabre sort of, ironic fairy tale story, like Wish Upon from a while back, another movie I enjoyed. A lot of fun.
Well, let's move on to Rampage. The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, is in the Rampage. He's a primatologist who has an unshakable bond with George. Now, Rafer, I confess, I have been subjected to this trailer about six times with the other movies I've been going to. Listen.
Of course. They've really been pushing.
Last night, he was 7 feet, 500 pounds. This morning, he's almost 9 feet, pushing 1,000.
Are you familiar with CRISPR?
Yeah, genetic engineering.
It's more like genetic editing. I am the only one who can cure him.
George is a ferocious but friendly gorilla. He winds up very large and in a pitched battle in some American city with a monster.
Yeah, you know, I was not expecting a lot out of this because, as you may or may not know, it's based on a video game, an old arcade-era video game from the 80s. Video game adaptations, not the most successful movie genre, I'm just going to say. But here you have The Rock. You've got some great special effects, and this is actually a really enjoyable action blockbuster. You know, listen, if you buy The Rock as a primatologist, then pretty much everything else in this movie will be an easy sell for you. And, you know, and I like this kind of stuff where, you know, you've heard Naomi Harris there as a geneticist trying to explain this stuff. Have you heard of CRISPR? You know, gene editing. It's the growth rate of a blue whale and the strength of a beetle. Okay, fine. That's all we need. I'm sold. The monsters look great. They destroy Chicago. You know, it's pretty inventive, pretty clever. They have a lot of fun with sort of Chicago as a giant jungle gym for these creatures. And I actually enjoyed it, much to my surprise.
I'm going to stop judging these movies based on the trailer alone because I rolled my eyes at both of these. I've seen the trailer and kind of snarked at it every time I see it, but maybe I'll put this one on the list too. I mean, I feel like I've seen the movie. I've seen the trailer so many times. But Rafer, I'm a big tennis fan, and I have been excited for our next film, Borg versus McEnroe. Shia LaBeouf is John McEnroe, on the ageless rivalry in the 80s between John McEnroe and Bjorn Borg from the headband era of professional tennis. Listen.
You can't be serious. You cannot be serious. The ball is on the line. Chalk flew up all over, man. The chalk flew up. You cannot possibly call that out.
I'm going to issue you a warning for unsportsmanlike behavior, Mr. McEnroe.
Now that sounds a lot like the real John McEnroe on center court at Wimbledon.
Yeah, I mean, you know, listen, let's face it. The real draw here for this movie is looking at Shia LaBeouf as John McEnroe. I mean, the similarities are just uncanny. I'm glad you mentioned the headband because, you know, once you put that headband on LaBeouf, suddenly they're just identical. You can't tell them apart. But, you know, of course, there's also the matter of these two people's personas, you know, the actor and the athlete, both sort of pariahs in their industry, both punchlines. And they're the guys that we love to hate. And yet, you know, in the movie, you watch John McEnroe kind of finally in this hard-won match win over the hearts of the Wimbledon crowd. And LaBeouf has been on a bit of a comeback, and I would say he's doing the same thing here. It's a really great performance. And you know what I like about it? It's an understated performance. It's not flashy, showy. You know, it doesn't feel like stunt casting. He's really delivering here. And I really enjoyed this movie. And if you're a tennis fan, maybe you know some of the history. I didn't know some of the backstories of these two guys, and a lot of that was really interesting, especially Bjorn Borg. So I like this movie a lot.
John McEnroe was a great American personality. Bjorn Borg, a great Swedish tennis champion, and their rivalry really was one for the ages in the 80s. All right, let's get back to trivia because it is Friday the 13th, Rafer. Now, I asked you just how many Friday the 13th movies there are. This isn't an easy answer. You want to take a crack at it?
So we're counting the Freddy versus Jason. We're counting the whole thing.
You're onto something
versus
here.
This Predator is why it's versus complicated. Alien. Okay, I'm going to have to try to keep this in. I'm going to take a wild guess and say 17.
Wow. Okay, you get half credit. The answer is 12, but this is complicated. It's 12 if you credit Freddy versus Jason. Now, a lot of people don't consider that canon. If you don't, it's 11. If you include Freddy versus Jason, it's 12. 17, you overshot it, but you're aware of the hot controversy here, Rafer. Good job.
Thank you, Todd. Thank you.
Rafer Guzman, film critic, Newsday in The Takeaway. Well, that's our show for today. Have a great Friday the 13th, and have a great weekend, and enjoy the springtime wherever you are. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.